Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on religious schools and the Sex Discrimination Act. As you know, we don't have formal debates, but we have people who present different views, and that's what we've got tonight. Now, we're going to lead off with Dr. Greg Walsh, who's a senior lecturer in the School of Law. Dr. Walsh teaches at the University of Notre Dame on the Sydney campus. And then after that, Dr. Amy Maguire. Amy Maguire is associate professor at the Newcastle Law School. We're leading off the discussion on religious schools and the Sex Discrimination Act. You're very welcome, Greg Walsh. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, everyone. So I might start with just an overview of the law for those of you who aren't familiar with the actual law as it is and the proposed amendments. So as was mentioned, the focus of this speech is on the Sex Discrimination Act. So under Section 21 of the Act, an educational authority is unable to discriminate on a range of grounds, including sexual orientation and gender identity. However, under Section 38, Subsection 3 of the Act, a protection is provided to educational institutions established for religious purposes so that they can make adverse decisions on the basis of a person's sexual orientation, gender identity, marital or relationship status, or pregnancy, so long as they are made in good faith in order to avoid injury to the religious susceptibilities of adherents of that religion or creed. Further protection under the Act is provided under Section 37, Subsection 1, Paragraph D of the Act, for an act or practice of a body established for religious purposes being an act or practice that conforms to the doctrines, tenets, or beliefs of that religion, or is necessary to avoid injury to the religious susceptibilities of adherents of that religion. So it's these sections which are the focus of the amendments that were introduced by Labor. So Labor's bill was called the Sex Discrimination Amendment Removing Discrimination Against Students Bill 2018. And essentially what this bill would have done if it had been accepted or approved, passed by the Parliament, it would have repealed the protections provided in Section 38(3) to religious schools and other religious educational institutions and limited the protection provided in Section 37(1)(d) to any body established for religious purposes so that it was no longer protected in relation to the provision of education unless the decision related to the employment of persons to provide that education. So if that bill had been passed, it would have had the desirable change of removing the ability of religious schools to expel students solely on the basis that they have a same-sex attraction or they're experiencing gender dysphoria. So that, if the bill had only done that, it would undoubtedly have passed because there's widespread agreement for that change, not just in Parliament, but also in the community, among religious leaders, as well as just general members of the community. However, if the bill had been enacted, it would have done far more than this. What it would have done, it would have meant that religious schools, religious universities, and other religious bodies providing education would have been unable to deny admission, expel, impose a detriment, or limit access to a benefit on grounds such as sexual orientation and gender identity. Again, that might sound reasonable until you reflect on the possible consequences that might flow from changing the Sex Discrimination Act in this way. So an example could be at an all-boys school, there's a 16-year-old boy at the school. He develops gender dysphoria and now wants his religious school to recognise that he is now a girl and to treat him accordingly, to use the name that he wants, to use the gender pronoun that he wants, to allow him to wear the uniform that he wants. Under the changes that the Labor Party, the Greens and some coalition members were willing to support, it's unclear why this would not or be considered to be imposing a detriment on the grounds of gender identity if the religious school refused to do that. At least it seems open under the amendment that the Labour Party wanted to make. Let's say the boy, 16-year-old boy, doesn't want to stay at the school but instead wants to transfer to an all-girls school. Again, it's unclear that that all-girls school would be able to say no to that boy who is now identifying as a girl. There is, under Section 21(3) of the Sex Discrimination Act, protection so that schools can be single-sex education, single-sex oriented, but the term sex isn't defined in the Sex Discrimination Act. So that possibility is definitely there. And one 16-year-old boy who is in the school, how would the school be able to stop that boy from accessing female change rooms, dormitories, competing in female-only sporting events without it being, at least potentially, a violation of the amended act? Similarly, if a religious school wants to teach a traditional understanding of sexual identity or sexuality, it's unclear how this will also be lawful under the changes if they were to be passed. If a school taught a traditional understanding of sexual ethics, so that sexual activity can only be valid or ethical if within a traditional marriage, or alternatively that our sexual identity is determined by biology, not our emotions, it's at least possible under the amended acts, and in my view likely, that a court could hold that this would mean that the school is imposing a detriment on the grounds of sexual orientation or gender identity. Also, as I mentioned, under the amended act, a school would be unable to limit access to a benefit on grounds such as sexual orientation and gender identity. So would this mean that programs like the Safe or Unsafe Schools program would have to be offered by a school on the basis that if it refused to, it would be limiting access to a benefit on the grounds that are protected? Also, the actual proposal that the Labor government and the Greens and others wanted to support wasn't just focused on religious schools. It covered religious universities. It also covered any religious organisation involved in providing education. So this means that the amended act would have regulated religious retreat centres, religious training facilities, even churches could have been covered by the amended act. So as you can understand, and as you recall last December, those who are following this issue, the amendments were highly controversial and a number of alternative amendments were proposed by the Coalition. But the Coalition's amendments themselves were limited putting it politely. So there were some of the bills, they would have retained the protection for bodies established for religious purposes, they would have provided protection that conforms to a school's religion, and they would have added some additional criteria that meant that if a religious school established a condition, a requirement or a practice that adversely affected a particular student, it could be considered to be lawful so long as a court considered that it was reasonable. But the amendments that they wanted to introduce were very limited, and so even if the Coalition's amendments had been accepted, religious schools and religious universities and religious organisations would still have been adversely affected in a fundamental way. So the situation we are at the moment, the bills weren't approved by the Parliament, but there are various investigations or inquiries underway. So one is the Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee, which is due to report next Monday when the Commonwealth Parliament resumes. And the Coalition also referred the matter to the Australian Law Reform Commission, and they are due to report in the second half of 2019 after the federal election, which was obviously a tactic for the Coalition. But it's highly likely that this matter will come back before the Commonwealth Parliament next week, and we'll be in the same situation we were in December, where these kind of amendments are being proposed that potentially will have a profoundly adverse effect on religious schools and other religious organisations. So my view on how the Sex Discrimination Act should be amended is as follows. So five key grounds. Firstly, there should be a maintenance of the general protection under Section 38, subsection 3. So long as a religious school operates in a way in accordance with its religious beliefs, it should be considered not to be acting unlawfully under the Sex Discrimination Act. And that's consistent with the Ruddock Report, the Religious Freedom Review, where they said so long as it was founded in the precepts of the religion, the school should be able to act in that way. So the second element of what I consider to be the preferable solution is that there should be an adoption of the RUDOC's recommendation of the best interests of the child, but with two modifications. Firstly, it should be in the best interest of the children that the religious school looks after, not solely this particular student. Schools there are primarily there to care for all of their students, not one particular student. And secondly, in considering the best interests of the child, it should be up to the religious school to make that decision. It shouldn't be something that the courts make, for the obvious reason that would make every single decision that a religious school made subject to assessment by a court, and so would expose the religious school to the potential of endless litigation. The third element, again, which was recommended by the Ruddock report, was to have a policy regarding how the religious school was planning to rely upon the protections provided to it. So that policy should be publicly available and provided to students and also parents when the student is being enrolled. Fourthly, the protection provided should be narrowed. There seems to be almost universal agreement that religious schools shouldn't be able to expel a student solely on the basis that they have a same-sex attraction or experiencing gender dysphoria. Limiting it in that way would have widespread support, and that kind of amendment itself would not be controversial, just solely on the basis that the student has same-sex attraction or experiencing gender dysphoria. The fifth element of what I recommend is a legislative statement saying that when a religious school makes a decision in accordance with its religious beliefs, it is not engaging in discrimination. So that was critical because so much of this debate is undertaken on the basis that what religious schools are doing here are acts of discrimination which they can only do lawfully because they are politically powerful enough to arrange for Parliament to provide them with this protection. Instead, alternatively, the preferable view is that religious schools, when they make this decision, they're doing it because it's just to allow them to make this decision. It's in accordance with a proper understanding of human rights law. So they're the five elements of what I propose to be the correct approach. And why I consider that to be the correct approach and a superior one to other bills that have been put before the Commonwealth Parliament is, firstly, the people who are pushing for amendments haven't actually made out their case that there is a major problem here. Greens, Labour politicians, some coalition politicians are of the view, or seem to be of the view, that there's some major crisis in our religious schools, our religious universities, our religious organisations, where students with same-sex attraction or gender dysphoria are subject to extraordinary adverse psychological pressure and their welfare is threatened. But the argument against there's some anecdotal evidence that's relied upon to support that position, but where is the stronger evidence that you would expect? All students now, or the majority of students now, have smartphones in their pocket. So if teachers or other employees at religious schools are engaging in this oppressive conduct towards students, where is the video evidence? Where is the audio evidence of this adverse conduct? There's an enormous number of religious schools that are teaching over a million students at religious schools. At the Catholic schools alone, there's 1,700 Catholic schools teaching more than 750,000 students. If there is this major problem, where is the evidence of it? The fact that there is no evidence come before the public is a strong indication that religious schools, religious universities are doing a very good job in caring for all of their students, including those with same-sex attraction and who are experiencing gender dysphoria. The second argument that's commonly made is that because religious schools, some religious universities, are receiving government funding, they shouldn't be able to discriminate. So the first argument against that, firstly, we shouldn't be using this term discriminate like that. That's an issue that you use that language at the end after you've concluded that the religious school is acting unjustly. But the view is that religious schools shouldn't have this protection because they're receiving government funding. So the first response to that is that Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists are themselves taxpayers, so the money that's going to religious institutions is coming from people who adhere to these particular religious beliefs. So a Christian have some of their money they pay in tax go towards a Christian school doesn't seem to me to be profoundly unjust. But perhaps an even more important point is that we don't take this approach to other organisations. So when, say, an Indigenous organisation receives government funding, no one says to that organisation, because you're receiving government funding, you shouldn't be able to have protection under the Anti-Discrimination Act. You shouldn't be able to exclude non-Indigenous people from your Indigenous organisation because you're receiving government funding. No one takes that kind of argument for the obvious reason the first primary, perhaps only consideration is it just for the government to support this organisation? And if so, what are the ways in which the government can support that organisation? And that can be through government funding, it can be through protection under anti-discrimination legislation, it can be through protection in a range of other ways. So another argument in favour of my way is a fairly obvious argument, is that it better protects religious liberty, which is considered to be, by many, to be a profoundly important right. Against that, though, is the argument that's always made, say, under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, Article 18, Paragraph 3, the limitation clause that's contained in this article, saying that religious liberty is very important, but it can be limited when it conflicts with other rights. And the right that always is used is equality. Because it conflicts with equality, we need to limit the protections that are currently provided to religious schools. There's a range of arguments, again, counters to that argument. Perhaps the strongest one is the right to equality doesn't just protect individuals who may be adversely affected by religious schools, but it also protects the religious schools themselves, the students at the religious schools, the parents at the religious schools, the members of the religious communities, because when you look at the right to equality under international human rights instruments, one of the grounds that it clearly protects is the ground of religion. So any law that adversely affects religious schools can be criticised for the basis that it violates the right to equality, and that's completely counter to the argument made by Labour and Greens and other people that these kind of protections are themselves violations of the right to equality. There are many other reasons why my proposal, something similar to it, is superior. It better respects parental rights, the rights of children to be raised in authentic religious education, to protect freedom of association, to better protect the government's commitment to multiculturalism. It has the merits of certainty, so people know where they stand, which has a reduction in the government resources that will need to be used to assess any litigation that may be required to work out what these tests actually mean and whether the religious school has complied with it. So they are the various reasons why I think my approach is superior. I don't actually think my approach is going to be accepted by the Commonwealth Parliament. I think it's very likely, considering how they acted in December, they'll push forward with their proposal, which will be a violation of religious liberty, freedom of association, all the rights that I talked about, which is why I recommend people who are concerned about this, they should contact Parliament as soon as possible, contact their MP, contact their senators, to let them know their displeasure about their attempts to undermine the operation of religious schools. If, as is likely, the parliamentarians, Labour, Liberal, National, Greens, will ignore the request to not actually amend the law in a way that's harmful to religious schools, my recommendation is to vote for parties that are committed to protecting religious liberty. I'm a proud member of the Australian Conservatives. We are dedicated to protecting religious schools. I recommend you look at that party if you're concerned about protecting religious liberty. If you're not, look at other political parties. But we need to punish politicians that don't adequately respect religious liberty and other important freedoms. Thank you.
So, Amy McGuire.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone, and thank you very much for the invitation, Jared, to be here tonight, and thank you to Dr. Walsh for proposing the topic. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land that we're meeting on, the Gadigal of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. A person of faith covers their face as an expression of their religious beliefs, but the state requires that they remove the cover in order to act as a witness before a court. A local council maintains a public facility on which is displayed the name of an historical figure. But local people of colour in the community object because the nickname of that person contains a racial epithet. In these types of examples, we can see the potential for tension between different human rights claims. So I'd like to begin by stepping back from the specific that Dr. Walsh has introduced to talk about the broader notion of human rights in the balance. Human rights are expressed in international law as universal, inalienable, and indivisible. There is no hierarchy of rights that provides easy and clear answers when they come into conflict. Inevitably, in a diverse society like ours, individuals and communities will differ about which rights standards they most prize. In such cases, rights may necessarily be constrained at times. This process of balancing rights is not untethered under international law. The Syracuse principles justify the limitation of a fundamental human right where the limitation is necessary, it pursues a legitimate aim, and is proportionate to the aim that it's pursuing. These principles of limitation are incorporated into the human rights law of many countries, the law in Victoria and the ACT, and by the Commonwealth Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, which adds that a measure limiting a human right must be prescribed by law, and that, in fact, is the subject of what we're talking about tonight. I would say that I prefer the phrasing rights in tension over rights in conflict, because the idea of tension implies, I think, more potential for reconciliation between claims that don't seem to balance easily. We witnessed several attempts to reconcile competing or rights in tension claims during the debate over marriage reform recently. And some of you may recall Liberal MP James Patterson putting forward a bill to legalise same-sex marriage while providing very wide-ranging protections for religious freedom. The bill sought to protect specific beliefs, including, for example, that the normative state of gender is binary. People holding such beliefs under that bill would have been protected by a new criminal offence of victimisation. These proposals risked privileging religious freedom in a way that would have created an artificial hierarchy of human rights protection, and they didn't win parliamentary support. This essential search for balance or reconciliation of rights claims is unfortunately particularly challenging in Australia, due to our lack of a genuine human rights discourse or culture. Australia is now the only democratic country in the world to lack a constitutional or statutory bill or charter of rights. And in this sense, Australia does not remotely meet its international legal obligations, which it has willingly consented to incorporate the full range of universal human rights standards into our domestic law and policy. This state of affairs undermines the assertion of the Australian government in its bid for the UN Human Rights Council, which was in any case successful, that human rights are, and I quote, national values deeply embedded in Australian society. I would argue that this absence denies our society the language and the precedent that should underpin the challenging but very important process of balancing rights that come into tension with each other. So in the debate regarding the extent to which religious schools ought to be permitted to discriminate against students or teachers on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity, various rights are in tension, and Dr. Walsh has mentioned several of these. There is the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, which, as Dr. Walsh mentioned, is unconstrained in its private sense, but which is subject to potential limitation in terms of its public manifestations in order to avoid undue infringement on the fundamental rights and freedoms of others. Human rights law, as we know, also strives to protect the right to equality of all people, including before the law, and generally prohibits discrimination which would undermine that equality. Other relevant rights here include a right to privacy, a right to family life, and the right of children to have their best interests prioritised. These considerations must sit alongside each other in their social context. The privileging of rights that are essential to a liberal or an individualistic worldview, such as the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, over rights to equality or freedom from discrimination, risks particular harm to some of the most vulnerable people in our society. Now, I acknowledge the significance of religious adherence to people of faith, and I believe that Australian law ought to protect the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. And in fact, that could be attended to in part through the passage of a new federal statute to outlaw discrimination on the basis of religion, and also potentially a prohibition on religious vilification. That would mean that discrimination on the basis of religion sat alongside protections against discrimination on the basis of race, sex, and disability in our law. Human rights law also respects the right of parents to ensure the religious education of their children in accordance with their own convictions. With more than 1 in 3 Australian children enrolled in religious schools and considerable government funding directed to that sector, it is clear that Australian society is heavily invested in the furtherance of that right. However, in like legal systems, including New Zealand, Ireland and the UK, the legal exemptions to discrimination law for freedom of religion in religious schools are significantly more limited than they are in Australia. In those countries, the freedom of religion of religious schools is attended to by exemptions that permit schools to exclude children of a different sex from a single-sex school and to refuse admission to students who do not adhere to the faith of a school community. In its response to the Ruddock Review, the Australian Government acknowledged the complexity of protecting school children from discrimination while maintaining the capacity of religious schools to operate consistently with their ethos. I accept the legitimacy of both of those objectives, while arguing that it is reasonable and necessary to limit religious freedom in the context of religious schools to protect the best interests of children and their rights to an education appropriate to their needs. So I support the removal of exemptions which permit direct discrimination against students in religious schools. For example, the most widely publicised case that Dr. Walsh mentioned of the capacity of a school to expel or exclude a student because they are gay. I accept that few, if any, religious schools in Australia wish to exercise such a power. But the likelihood that a power may be exercised is not the key question when we consider whether it should exist in our law at all. Any LGBT child in Australia should know that the law does not permit them to be denied the education of their family's choice because of a feature of their personhood. I do not support exemptions which would permit unreasonable indirect discrimination against students in religious schools. For example, where a school may seek to prevent students from forming clubs or discussion groups that are perceived as challenging the school's ethos. In such a case, LGBT students wouldn't be singled out, not directly discriminated against, but the effect of the school's policy may be indirectly discriminatory towards them, because it may be more likely that a support group for LGBT students will highlight the incongruity between the school's ethos and their identities. The existing reasonable defence into indirect discrimination in the Sex Discrimination Act is sufficient already to allow schools to operate within their ethos. I note the concern of religious organisations that teachers in religious schools ought to protect and maintain their school's ethos. On this point, schools should have a capacity to require, for example, that teachers engaged in religious instruction be willing to adhere to the school's ethos in that instruction. Such a position could clearly be characterised as a genuine occupational requirement, and that approach is consistent with, for example, the approach of the European Court of Human Rights, which has balanced these competing rights or these rights in tension in numerous cases. I would distinguish such a case from what I regard as an unreasonable capacity for religious schools to refuse to hire or to terminate the employment of any teacher, staff member or contractor on the basis of their sexual orientation. Such a capacity is not consistent with human rights jurisprudence. To explain these positions, I turn to my own life experience. As someone raised in the Catholic tradition, I am well aware of that church's teachings on, for example, sexuality, contraception, euthanasia and assisted reproductive technologies, all the controversies. I was made aware of those teachings through church services and through teaching in my school. I'm also aware that many people who identify as Catholic would, regardless of church dogma, have differing views from the church on these matters. Indeed, I was educated alongside openly gay and bisexual children. In my observation, then, it is possible both to identify as an adherent of a faith community and diverge from that tradition's official teachings on a given matter. In removing exemptions that permit discrimination against LGBT students in religious schools, Australian law would not remove the capacity for those schools to express their ethos through religious instruction. As late as the 1960s, It was a widely held view that a woman's place, once she was married and a mother especially, was in the home and not also in the workplace. My own mother, at that time a young and enthusiastic primary school teacher, was working in country Victoria and became pregnant with her first child. She was immediately compelled by her school to resign. 5 decades on, neither our law nor our social expectations permit the exclusion of pregnant women or mothers from the workplace. I'm a direct beneficiary of that change. Today, our society is challenged to consider the extent to which our law should permit discrimination in education against children on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. In this inquiry, we may acknowledge that we are constantly growing in our understanding of the diversity of human life and experience. That diversity has always and will continue to challenge social norms and call for nuanced understandings of what equality requires. My views on this issue are also founded in a sense that we ought to weigh the relative harms risked or inflicted by capacities to discriminate when we consider if a limitation on a human right is proportionate. In the context of discrimination against students in religious schools on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity, a range of potential harms may be advanced. For example, I was reading an article that Dr. Walsh published recently in The Spectator, where he noted the experience of Catholic Archbishop of Hobart, Archbishop Porteous, who in Dr. Walsh's phrasing was subjected to a vilification complaint for publishing a pamphlet advocating traditional marriage. I note that the vilification complaint was eventually withdrawn. There was no decision against the Archbishop. So the harm we're talking about there is the experience of being complained against and having to wrangle with that complaint for some time before it disappeared. And it can be characterised as harm, of course. It could also be characterised as an uncomfortable but important interaction that demonstrates the capacity of an open democratic society to test the appropriate balance of rights when they come into tension. In fact, I would say the Archbishop acknowledged as much before a parliamentary committee last year when he said that the conciliation process was valuable, the personal interaction with the complainant having given him a greater understanding of their position. Meanwhile, still on this idea of harm, many advocates for the removal of exemptions from discrimination law in the area raise the prospect of other types of harms being imposed on LGBT children. It is well established, and it is empirically established, that the experience of discrimination has detrimental effects on the mental health of LGBT people. LGBT young people in religious schools have been shown to be more likely than their peers in non-religious schools to experience social exclusion, bullying, homophobic language and attacks, and to feel negatively about their same-sex attraction and report suicidal ideation. In this context, we must consider the appropriate degree of intervention by the state. Governments must prioritise the best interests of children in their regulation of schools. While the freedom of religion dictates that schools be permitted to operate within a religious ethos, that right is not absolute. Children are entitled to special protection because they are more vulnerable than adults and they lack equal capacity to assert their rights. Weighing rights in the balance, the religious freedom of schools must be somewhat constrained in law because the best interests of a child cannot be advanced through discrimination that is based on their sexual orientation or their gender identity. Thank you.
Thanks to Dr. Walsh and Dr. McGuire. So we're coming to questions and discussion. So if one of you comes to this side and one of you comes to that side, Amy, you come to this side. And you'll need to speak up a bit because you're very tall. Amy, you come in. And you come here. It's not that hard. You go over there. You go over there. And I'm over here. Now, I just want to make one clarification for some of the younger members of the audience. I think it's fair to say in relation to your mother that
in the 1960s, a married woman had to leave the employment of the Commonwealth and state public services. I mean, it was that kind of discrimination was widespread. They weren't even allowed to be pregnant. They weren't allowed to be married in the Commonwealth and state. Now, we're off to... The country, since as I've moved along, it seems to be full of lawyers, of human rights lawyers at various institutions, and we've got two fine examples here today. So what I'm asking both of you, was everyone asleep? Because when this legislation came in, which I think was the Labor government, wasn't it, which was Mark Dreyfus was the Attorney General, was it the Gillard government or the Rudd government, the ones that's been examined now? Which government brought it in?
Gillard.
The Gillard government. No one seemed to say a thing about it. And this issue only really arose probably in the last year. But what happened in the various universities when this legislation was brought in under Julia Gillard's government, and I think with the support of the opposition then? So it was bipartisan. Only, 7 or 8 years ago? What was going on? Let's start off with...
I've got a little bit.
Okay, you start off.
From recollection, this might be a bit inaccurate, but it was about the time when they were trying to bring about... They were thinking, firstly, the Charter of Rights, and you recall there was the Frank Brennan and others went around the country talking about our human rights protection and what additional protections would be required. It turned out that there was enormous community opposition to the Charter of Rights. Then there was attempts to try and consolidate discrimination legislation, and a lot of conservative religious individuals realised that was undesirable as well. And so the Labor government backed away from that, and so to some kind of face-saving mechanism was to try and change a few laws, and one of the ones they did was to introduce the grounds of transgender status and sexual orientation and intersex status into the Sex Discrimination Act, and made it clear that these provisions applied. They didn't touch the religious schools protection that existed or the protection provided for religious organisations, with the exception that they would no longer allow Commonwealth organisations providing care to elderly people to discriminate on these grounds. So that was, as I understand it, but I mean, that's off the top of my head.
I'll go here first.
I guess this is a question for Dr. McGuire, Lord and Greg, but you mentioned that the Australian law wouldn't, if 38.3 was removed, that it wouldn't prevent a school from passing on its ethos via, you know, instruction. At the previous Senate inquiry, there was a suggestion that even a religious school teaching against assisted reproduction would, in fact, offend against the discrimination provisions because of rainbow families and stuff like that, and the way that they are created largely through assisted reproductive technologies. And then to Greg's point about the required inclusion of, like, safe schools type material. So how does that square with the claim that it wouldn't affect instruction?
The claim is based on there being a capacity already existing under the law for a defence of reasonableness to what is in effect indirect discrimination. So, for example, a school might require that all of its students attend church services, and there's nothing about that violates the discrimination law, because it would be regarded as reasonable should somebody who felt unfairly indirectly targeted complain. So what we're talking about here is, instead of a blanket permissiveness, if you like, trying to find the balance between different people's views over which rights are most important to them. And I appreciate fully that is both a highly complex exercise and also potentially one that will heighten litigation for a time. And yet I don't mind, because I think that they're the sorts of conversations that we need to have if we're going to continue to pursue equality in our society, aware of the very diverse needs of its members.
You want to add to that, or?
Just briefly. A few points. So, I don't think we should underestimate the litigation complexity of putting in a test. There's many people who are profoundly opposed to religious schools, and they will challenge them as often as they can using the litigation. And that's a particular problem for the smaller religious schools, the smaller religious communities, the Catholic schools, the Anglican schools, backed by their financial resources. The smaller schools will just crumble and concede and won't bother to litigate. So that's a key concern I have. And again, I just want to pick up that point that Dr. Maguire was talking about in terms of equality. So I just want to go back to that point again. If we don't structure the Sex Discrimination Act correctly to protect religious schools, we will be violating the right to equality. So we shouldn't concede that these kind of provisions that are currently here need to be changed to protect the right to equality. They're there in order to protect the right to equality as well as other rights like religious liberty and parental rights of children.
This debate is carried out under the heading of religious freedom. I'd suggest that to the person in the street, religious freedom means the freedom to practice one's own religion, but not the freedom to discriminate on the basis of one's religion. Freedom from discrimination, not freedom to discriminate. If the principle that a religious school can discriminate on the basis of its religion is accepted, couldn't that same principle also be used to justify such heinous practices as denying education to women, female genital mutilation, racist choices in education?
Okay, got the point. Who wants to respond?
Yes.
First I'd say that, we have to go back to this meaning of what we understand by equality, what we understand by discrimination. The essence of it is these are just synonyms for the term justice. So that's what we should be focused on. Is it unjust for the religious school to operate in this way? The examples you talked about, we'd widely agree that they are unjust, that they should not be permitted. But in terms of religious schools, we would actually support things like, racial discrimination, for example. There's a few indigenous schools in the community. No one's going to say it's unjust for these indigenous schools to say no to a non-Indigenous student so they can build up an environment in that school which is supportive of Indigenous culture. If we said to that Indigenous school, all you can do is teach in a way that's supportive of Indigenous ideas and culture and heritage and religion, but you can't exclude non-Indigenous students, what that would mean is the Indigenous students are deprived of an opportunity to learn about their culture, their language, their religion from other Indigenous students. So we'd understand that's an enormous harm to those students. That it's the exact same kind of argument can be made in the context of religious schools.
I might just add on that point, though, that, of course, such an example would be a special measure under the Race Discrimination Act, which is a different area of law from what we've been discussing. And it's an area where we see the law permitting what's called positive discrimination to try to achieve substantive equality in our community rather than formal equality before the law.
Isn't it?
Can I respond to Dr. Maguire's point?
Yeah.
So the concept of special measures and positive discrimination is substantive equality. These are all important points. But firstly, we shouldn't forget that religious communities have a long history of discrimination in our society. Jewish Australians can talk to you in detail about the kind of discrimination they've suffered from the clubs that they've not been allowed to join. So if you're talking about needing to overcome past discrimination, Jewish schools should definitely be able to be fit within this means. Similarly, Catholics. Many Catholics can recall ads that ended with CNNA, Catholics need not apply. And so there's a clear animus directed against Catholics in our history again. So Catholics could say they need to have this kind of protection to overcome the disadvantage. But again, we need to go back to these terms like substantive equality and recognise that what we're talking about here, when we talk about equality, we're talking about justice. What is the just outcome in the situation? What's the just approach for the law to take in this situation? It's just to allow Indigenous schools to ensure that only Indigenous students are part of their school. It's also just for religious schools to ensure that they can include students who are compatible with their religion within their school as well. So we should recognise that the term equality is being used by those who are critical of religious schools in a way that's not consistent with international human rights law, and we should not allow these people to attack religious schools through a misuse of equality.
Question up here.
Section 116 of the Constitution contains that the Commonwealth shall not prohibit the free exercise of any religion. And it seems to me that what we've developed now, and I know the Constitution has been completely reinterpreted by the High Court over many, many decades, But where does Section 116 sit now, when it was brought in to ensure that the Commonwealth would not override the power of the states? So now we've got a situation where the Marriage Act conflicts with Section 116. So what's going to happen there?
Probably have a view on a specific point at the end.
Okay, yeah, I do. So, well, Section 116, it's a very limited right, as you might know. It only limits the Commonwealth laws, not state laws. Also, Section 116 has been interpreted by the High Court in a purposive way, so legislation will only be invalid if the purpose of the law is to limit religious liberty. So in that sense, it's a very limited right. So in terms of it actually having a huge role to play in this topic of working out how religious schools should be regulated under discrimination law, it doesn't appear to be of great relevance.
But if a church school was told it couldn't teach the religion of the church, that should apply.
And I haven't encountered any proposal for amendment of the law that would prevent a religious school from teaching its religion and instruction.
There's a question here. This question, could you?
Yes.
A question to Professor Maguire. You suggested that it would be reasonable for religious schools to require teachers of religion to support the ethos of the school. But what about in a school where every teacher is a teacher of religion? That is to say that religious perspectives infuse the teaching of all of the academic subjects. And what about a school which relies not just on the teaching within its religious education subject, but on the lifestyle witness of all of the staff in terms of manifesting the ethos of the school? Where would you see that?
I believe that if a school is constituted in a way where every teacher is engaged in religious instruction, then it's not unreasonable to require that all of those teachers are qualified in a religious sense to engage in that religious instruction, and I think that that would fit within the reasonableness defence. To your second point, my view is that on the balance of rights, where we see tension, somebody's sexual orientation or gender identity ought not to be a bar to their employment. And that was why I mentioned in my remarks my life experience of encountering many religious people who would adhere to some of the precepts of their faith's teaching and not all. Because I know that there are now in Australia many teachers teaching in religious schools who adhere to the faith, are very keen to stay in that school rather than move into the public system, for example, and yet feel that they can't share details of their private life with their colleagues and live in fear of the termination of their employment. And to me, that's not right, because a person's sexual orientation or gender identity is part of who they are. It's not a choice that they make.
A question for you, Dr. Maguire. Context, first of all, CEO of Anglican Schools Corporation here in Sydney. First of all, thank you for that phrase, rights in tension versus rights in conflict. I think that's very helpful and very useful. First comment, you'll be aware, no doubt, of the letter that was signed by the 34 Anglican schools. And I can say that none of my schools and none of the other schools in that group that I know of as well actually want the exemptions retained with respect to children and the right to expel the children. So please take that on like that.
You've got to be brief.
I am. You should hear me when I go along. I wanted to just follow up on Dr. Collier's remarks on the genuine occupational requirements. And we have a school, for example, where the most effective missionary person in the school is actually the gardener. So we need to be conscious of that. And if we limit this to just the genuine occupational requirements, I think it's actually a blow against our pluralistic society that we value. I understand that's more a comment than a question, so thank you.
Does anyone want to reply to the comment rather than the question? Okay, so.
Is there any plausibility to the theory that religious doctrines basically
were adopted and have been maintained from a period in which things tended to be seen in social terms rather starkly as either black or white, and that in 2019, on the whole, the communities of which we speak don't see things in quite such stark terms now, and that when one talks about respecting the right to practice one's religion, is there an element of really sanctioning perpetuation of approaches to social or religious or moral questions which are to some extent anachronistic?
Okay, right.
Thank you for your question. This is why I feel so strongly that we're bereft while we don't have a proper human rights framework in our law. It's because it robs us of the capacity to talk through these issues in not black and white terms, and that's the only way we can properly resolve them, in my view, is by gaining an understanding of other people's position. So, for example, when I was speaking earlier, I mentioned that in trying to work towards reform in this area, we might add a law that offers a different kind and a further level of protection for religious freedom. That would be a Religious Discrimination Act. So we're not talking only about taking protections away. We're talking about adjusting where they sit and how they balance with other protections and rights.
Just 2 points, I might do.
Chair,
respond to that. Oh, right. So, one thing I liked about the proposal by the committee was this view of having a policy which has to be publicly presented to the public, obviously, and also the students and their parents, because it allows the school to change its policies, which does happen. Schools change their views on religious issues, and so they can just update and change their policy. So that way, it allows the religious community to change. It's the protection that's provided to it. So that's an advantage which I like of that approach compared to other ones. Just on the Charter of Rights, Bill of Rights, Human Rights Act kind of question, I know it's slightly different, but I'm very sceptical as to whether that's a good approach to raise. If we really want to care about human rights, we shouldn't call these things Charter of Rights, Bill of Rights. What they're about is moving the decision from Parliament to the courts, allowing lawyers who act as advocates to play the important role of determining what a just law is, a just policy is. No one thinks it's a good idea to have solicitors, no one should think it's a good idea to have 7 lawyers decide this issue rather than 200 plus parliamentarians who are representative of the community. It's not about improving human rights protection, it's about changing human rights protection and giving a greater role to lawyers. I know it's a different topic, but I had to say that.
You've got to be brief, you've got a few minutes.
Dr. Walsh.
Yes.
Most of us here, the majority of us here, were brought up in an understanding of that our community was a Judeo-Christian community.
It seems to me that these important decisions that we've been talking about are made by, at this moment, and could be in the future, by hung parliaments. Why are we not reverting to the common law and our heritage in the law so that sensible long-term decisions can be made rather than knee-jerk reactions?
Well, when you say reverting to the common law, that presumably means you'd prefer the judges to be developing the law, and in which case I don't know if that would be necessarily the wisest approach to take, unless you're of the view of, you agree with the worldview that the majority of judges seem to have, which I don't know if necessarily is the right worldview. And in terms of the point, why don't people, I suppose just people just don't agree in Parliament at the moment. People have just different worldviews, so inevitably you have the disagreement as to what our legislation should be. So I'm not sure if that answers the question.
You want to comment?
We'll
go to the second last question here. We've got to be brief, yeah?
The question about Bill of Human Rights, when that has been on the agenda or being discussed, there's an enormous opposition. And I think that opposition has come from the countries that you have said are doing well by having this
a Bill of Human Rights.
Okay, just want to make a brief response on human rights, and that's the second last question here, okay?
Oh, very briefly, because I think this gentleman is waiting as
no,
well.
No, he hasn't got time. Okay. Just talking to the microphone.
I don't accept that view of things, and I think it really depends where you get your information from as to whether or not people approve or disapprove. But one thing that I would say, going back to what Dr. Walsh mentioned about this topic a few minutes ago, is that I don't think getting better human rights protection into our law is about giving more power to lawyers and judges. I think it's about giving all of us, as citizens of the society, better capacity to have important conversations. And if we look at human rights in tension and disputes in other places, including in Victoria and the ACT, it'll be coming soon in Queensland as well, there are conciliation processes happening that get people around a table together to talk these things through and understand each other's interpretations of their rights. That's where the important conversations happen.
Now, final question. I just want to ask both of you. We'll start off with Greg and go to Amy. As you said, Parliament resumes next week. It's only, I think, 8 sitting days to the budget. So in this area, what we're discussing tonight is legislation. Do you think it's likely to get through? And if you had your way, what would the kind of outcome you would both wish? So let's start with you, because you led off, and then let's go to...
Well, regarding the outcome, it would be something like the proposal that I mentioned in my presentation, something along those lines, which provides a general protection for schools, which doesn't involve a test that a court has to apply, which has enormous number of problems in terms of litigation threats, the uncertainty as to how a religious school will be regulated under that test, and the likelihood that the test established and how it will be interpreted will be oppressive to religious schools. How I consider it is going to unfold, it's very hard to know. I'm sorry, I don't actually know. The amendment might come through. There's a lot of work being done, but I don't actually know whether an amendment will come or whether it will just be pushed back to after the election, which I suspect is what the coalition would want.
I agree that it's very unlikely that we'll see any legislative action in this area until after the election, and you know that may well leave the issue for a future Labor government. They will have the benefit of several reports and tens of thousands of submissions to former inquiries over the past few years to sift through and work out an approach. My view is that we should be opposing exemptions to discrimination law that permit direct discrimination against students or employees in religious schools, that we should gain as a society a better understanding of the capacity for reasonable indirect discrimination where that is required to permit a school to operate within its ethos.
Many thanks. Thank you. I know there were more questions tonight, but we always aim to finish on time, and that's what we're doing again. Look, many thanks to Dr. Greg Walsh and Dr. Amy McGuire. I learned a lot tonight. This is a contentious issue. It's become kind of a prominent issue in recent times, but it certainly created a lot of interest, as you mentioned, with the various submissions that went forward to Parliament. And what we have had here tonight is not a formal debate. We're not taking a vote. We've had two articulate, intelligent lawyers stating a case on the legislation, looking historically and looking forward, but particularly focusing on what's before the Parliament, maybe early this year, maybe later this year, but probably sometime this year. So we'll be publishing both papers and the Sydney papers online, and they'll both our speakers have an opportunity to write a bit more than what they've been able to say tonight, put in some of the other comments. But everyone kept to time tonight, so we're going to finish on time tonight. And thanks to both of you, and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.